wrong. I couldn't help it. All I knew about Victorian slums I'd learned from the campy musical version of Oliver Twist. When I was 12, I'd been in a community theater production of it. I was orphan number 5, if you must know, and had suffered such terrible stage fright on the night of the show that I faked a stomach flu and watched the whole thing from the wings, in costume, with a barf bucket between my legs. Anyway, such was the scene in my head when I noticed a small hole in the tarp near my shoulder, chewed by rats, no doubt, and, shifting a little, I found I could peek through it. Within seconds, the happy, musical-inspired landscape I'd imagined melted away like a Salvador Dali painting. The first horror to greet me were the houses that lined the canal, though calling them houses was generous. Nowhere in their sagging and rotted architecture could be found a single straight line. They slouched like a row of exhausted soldiers who'd fallen asleep at attention. It seemed the only thing keeping them from tipping straight into the water was the tightness with which they were packed, that and the mortar of black and green filth that smeared their lower thirds in thick, sludgy strata. On each of their rickety porches, a coffin-like box stood on end, but only when I heard a loud grunt issue from one and saw something tumble into the water from beneath it, did I realize what they were, or that the slapping sounds I'd heard earlier hadn't come from oars, but from outhouses, which were contributing to the very filth that held them up. The women calling to one another from across the canal were leaning from opposite windows, just as I'd imagined, but they weren't hanging laundry, and they certainly weren't trading gossip, at least not anymore. Now they were trading insults and issuing threats. One waved a broken bottle and laughed drunkenly, while the other shouted epithets I could barely understand.
"You're nothing but a stinking dolly mop who'd lay with the devil himself for a farthing."
Which was ironic, if I took her meaning correctly, because she was herself stripped to the waist and didn't seem to mind who noticed. Both stopped to whistle down at Sharon as we passed, but he ignored them. Eager to wipe that image from my head, I managed to replace it with something even worse. Ahead of us was a gang of kids swinging their feet from a rickety footbridge that spanned the canal. They were dangling a dog above the water by a rope tied around its hind legs, dipping the poor creature under water and cackling when its desperate barks turned to bubbles. I resisted an urge to kick the tarp away and scream at them. At least Addison couldn't see. If he had, no amount of reasoning would have stopped him from going after them with teeth bared, blowing our cover.
"I see what you're up to," Sharon muttered at me. "If you want to have a look around, just wait. We'll be through the worst of it in a tick."
"Are you peeking?"
Emma whispered, poking me.
"Maybe,"
I said, still doing it. The boatman shushed us. Drawing his pole from the water, he uncapped the handle to expose a short blade, then held it out to sever the boy's rope as we drifted by. The dog splashed into the water and paddled gratefully away, and howling with rage, the boys began to improvise projectiles to throw at us. Sharon pushed on, ignoring them as he had the ladies, until a flying apple core missed his head by inches. Then he sighed, turned, and calmly pulled back the hood of his cloak, just enough so that the boys could see him, but I couldn't. Whatever they saw must have scared them half to death, because all ran screaming from the bridge, one so fast he tripped and fell into the fetid water. Chuckling to himself, Sharon readjusted his hood before facing forward again.
"What's happened?"
Emma said, alarmed. What was that?
A devil's acre welcome, replied Sharon. Now, if you care to see where we are, you may uncover your faces a bit, and I'll attempt to give you your gold coins worth of tour guiding with the time we have left.
We pulled the edge of the tarp down to our chins, and both Emma and Addison gasped. Emma, I think, at the sight, and Addison, judging from his wrinkled nose, at the smell. It was unreal, like a stew of raw sewage simmering all around us.
You get used to it,
Sharon said, reading my puckered face. Emma gripped my hand and moaned,
Oh, it's awful.
And it was. Now that I could see it with both eyes, the place looked even more hellish. The foundations of every house were decomposing into mush. Crazy wooden footbridges, some no wider than a board, crisscrossed the canal like a cat's cradle, and its stinking banks were heaped with trash and crawling with spectral forms at work sifting through it. The only colors were shades of black, yellow, and green, the flag of filth and decay, but black most of all. Black stained every surface, smeared every face, and striped the air in columns that rose from chimneys all around us, and, more ominously, from the smokestacks of factories in the distance, which announced themselves on the minute with industrial booms, deep and primal like war drums, so powerful they shook every window yet unbroken.
This, friends, is Devil's Acre,
Sharon began, his slithering voice just loud enough for us to hear.
Actual population, 7,206. Official population, 0. The city fathers, in their wisdom, refuse even to acknowledge its existence. The charming body of water in whose current we're currently drifting is called Fever Ditch, and the factory waste, night soil, and animal carcasses which flow perpetually into it are the source not only of its bewitching odor, but also of disease outbreaks so regular you could set your watch to them, and so spectacular that this entire area has been dubbed the capital of cholera. And yet...
He raised a black-draped arm toward a young girl, lowering a bucket into the water.
For many of these unfortunate souls, it serves as both sewer and spring.
She isn't going to drink that, Emma said, horrified.
In a few days, once the heavy particles settle, she'll skim the clearest liquid from the top.
Emma recoiled.
No.
Yes. Terrible shame,
Sharon said casually, then continued rattling off facts as if reciting from a book.
The citizenry's primary occupations are rubbish-picking and luring strangers into the acre to cosh them on the head and rob them. For amusement, they ingest whatever flammable liquids are at hand and sing badly at the top of their lungs. The area's main exports are smelted iron slag, bone meal, and misery. Notable landmarks include...
It isn't funny, Emma interrupted.
Pardon me?
I said it isn't funny. These people are suffering, and you're making jokes about it.
I am not making jokes,
Sharon replied imperiously.
I'm providing you with valuable information that may save your life. But if you'd rather plunge into this jungle cocooned in ignorance...
We wouldn't, I said. She's very sorry. Please keep going. Emma shot me a disapproving look, and I disapproved right back at her. This was no time to take a stand on political correctness, even if Sharon sounded a bit heartless.
"Keep your voices down, for Adie's sake," Sharon said irritably. "Now, as I was saying, notable landmarks include St. Rutledge's Foundlings Prison, a forward-thinking institution which jails orphans before they've had the opportunity to commit any crimes, thereby saving society enormous cost and trouble. St. Barnabas's Asylum for Lunatics, Mountbanks, and the Criminally Mischievous, which operates on a voluntary outpatient basis and is nearly always empty. And Smoking Street, which has been in flames for 87 years due to an underground fire no one's bothered to extinguish. Ah, he said, pointing to a blackened clearing between houses on the bank. Here's one end of it which, as you can see, is burnt to a crisp.
Several men were at work in the clearing, hammering on a wooden frame, rebuilding one of the houses, I assumed, and when they saw us passing, they stopped to shout hello to Sharon, who gave just a token wave back, as if slightly embarrassed. "Friends of yours?" I asked.
"Distant relations," he muttered. "Gallows rigging is our family trade."
"What rigging?" said Emma.
Before he could answer, the men had resumed work, singing loudly as they swung their hammers.
"Hark to the clinking of hammers! Hark to the driving of nails! What fun to build a gallows! The cure for all that ails!"
If I hadn't been so horrified, I might have broken out laughing. We coursed steadily down Fever Ditch. Like hands closing around us, it seemed to narrow with every stroke of Sharon's staff, sometimes so dramatically that the footbridges crossing it became unnecessary. You could practically leap across the water from roof to roof, the gray sky but a crack between them, suffocating all below in gloom. All the while, Sharon nattered on like a textbook come to life. In just a few minutes he'd managed to cover fashion trends in Devil's Acre. Stolen wigs hung from belt loops were popular, its gross domestic product, firmly in the negative, and the history of its settlement, by enterprising maggot farmers in the early 12th century. He was just launching into the highlights of its architecture when Addison, who'd been squirming next to me through it all, finally interrupted him.
"You seem to know every last fact about this hellhole, with the exception of anything that would be remotely useful to us."
"Such as?"
Sharon said, his patience thinning.
"Whom can we trust here?"
"Absolutely no one."
"How can we find the peculiars who live in this loop?" said Emma.
"You don't want to."
"Where are the whites holding our friends?" I asked.
"It's bad for business to know things like that,"
Sharon replied evenly.
"Then let us off this accursed boat, and we'll set about finding them ourselves," said Addison. "We're wasting precious time, and your endless monologuing is putting me to sleep. We hired a boatman, not a schoolmarm."
Sharon harrumphed.
"I should dump you into the ditch for being so rude. But if I did, I'd never get the gold coins you owe me."
"Gold coins!" said Emma, fairly spitting with disgust. "What about the well-being of your fellow peculiars? What about loyalty?"
Sharon chuckled.
"If I cared about things like that, I'd have been dead long ago."
"And wouldn't we all be better off?" Emma muttered, and looked away.
As we were talking, tendrils of fog had begun to curl around us. It was nothing like the gray mists of Cairnholm. This was greasy and yellow-brown, the color and consistency of squash soup. Its sudden appearance seemed to make Sharon uneasy, and as the view ahead dimmed, His head turned quickly from side to side, as if he were on the lookout for trouble, or searching for a spot to dump us.
"Drat, drat, drat," he muttered. "This is a bad sign."
"It's only fog," said Emma. "We're not afraid of fog."
"Neither am I," said Sharon. "But this isn't fog. It's murk, and it's man-made. Nasty things happen in the murk, and we must get out of it as quickly as we can."
He hissed at us to cover ourselves, and we did. I retreated to my peeking hole. Moments later, a boat emerged from the murk and passed close by, going the opposite direction. A man was at the oars, and a woman sat in the seat, and though Sharon said good morning, they only stared back, and continued staring until they were well past us, and the murk had swallowed them up again. Grumbling under his breath, Sharon maneuvered us toward the left bank and a small dock I could just barely make out. But when we heard footsteps on the wooden planks and a low murmur of voices, Sharon leaned on his pole to turn us sharply away. We zigzagged from bank to bank, looking for a place to land, but each time we got close, Sharon would see something he didn't like and turn away again.
"Vultures," he muttered. "Vultures everywhere."
I didn't see any myself until we passed beneath a sagging footbridge and a man crossing above us. As we drifted under him, the man stopped and looked down. He opened his mouth and drew a deep breath, about to yell for help, I thought. But rather than a voice, what came out of his mouth was a jet of heavy yellow smoke that shot toward us like water from a fire hose. I panicked and held my breath. What if it was poison gas? But Sharon wasn't covering his face or reaching for a mask. He was just muttering, "Drat, drat, drat," while the man's breath swirled around us, merging with the murk and reducing our visibility to nothing. Within a few seconds, the man, the bridge he stood on, and the banks on either side of us had all been blotted out. I uncovered my head, no one could see us now anyway, and said quietly, "When you said this stuff was man-made, I thought you meant by smokestacks, not literally."
"Oh, wow," Emma said, uncovering herself. "What's it for?"
"The vultures will murk an area to cloak their activities," Sharon said, "and to blind their prey. Fortunately for you, I am not easily preyed upon."
And he drew his long staff from the water, passed it over our heads, and used it to tap the wooden eyeball at the bow of his boat. The eyeball began to glow like a fog lamp, piercing the murk before us. Then he returned his staff to the water and, leaning heavily on it, spun the boat in a slow circle, sweeping the water around us with his light.
"But if they're making this," said Emma, "then they're peculiar, aren't they? And if they're peculiar, perhaps they're friendly."
"The pure of heart don't end up as ditch pirates," said Sharon,
and then he stopped the turning boat as our light fixed upon another approaching vessel.
"Speak of the devil."
We could see them clearly enough, but for now all they would see of us was a glary bloom of light. It wasn't much of an advantage, but at least it allowed us to size them up before we had to retreat beneath the tarp. They were two men in a boat about twice the size of our own. The first man was operating a nearly silent outboard motor, and the second held a club.
"If they're so dangerous," I whispered, "why are we just waiting for them?"
"We're too deep inside the acre to escape them now, and I can most likely talk us out of this."
"And if you can't?" said Emma.
"You may have to swim for it."
Emma glanced at the oily black water and said,
I'd rather die.
That's your choice. Now, I recommend you disappear, children, and don't move a muscle under there.
We drew the tarp over our heads again. A moment later, a hearty voice called out,
Ho there, boatmen!
Ho there,
replied Sharon. I heard oars drag the water, and then felt a jolt as the other boat knocked against ours.
What's your business here?
Merely out for a pleasure cruise, Sharon said lightly.
And a fine day for it,
the man replied, laughing. The second man wasn't in the mood for jokes.
What's under the rag?
He growled, his accent nearly impenetrable.
What I carry on my boat is my own business.
Anything passes through Fever Ditch, it's our business.
Oh, ropes and bric-a-brac, if you must know, said Sharon. Nothing of interest.
Then you won't mind us having a look,
said the first man.
What about our arrangement? Haven't I paid you this month?
Ain't no arrangement no more, said the second. Whites are paying 5 times a going rate for nice plump feeders, and he has let a feeder slip away. It's the pit, or worse.
What could be worse than the pit?
Said the first.
I don't intend to find out.
Now, gentlemen, be reasonable, said Sharon. Perhaps it's time to renegotiate. I can offer terms competitive with anyone.
Feeders. I shivered despite a clammy warmth building under the tarp from Emma's quickly heating hands. I hoped she wouldn't need to use them, but the men weren't budging, and I feared the boatman's blabber would stall them only so long. A fight would mean disaster, though. Even if we could take out the men in the boat, the vultures, as Sharon had said, were everywhere. I imagined a mob forming, coming after us in boats, firing on us from the banks, jumping onto us from the footbridges, and I began to freeze up with fear. I really, really did not want to find out what feeders meant. But then I heard a hopeful sound, the clink of coins being exchanged, and the second man was saying,
Why, he's loaded! I can retire to Spain with this.
But just as my hopes were rising, my stomach began to sink. A familiar old feeling crept into my belly, and I realized it had been building, slowly and gradually, for some time. It started as an itch, then became a dull ache, and now that ache was sharpening, the telltale tug of a nearby hollowgast. But not just any hollow. My hollow. The word popped into my head without warning or precedent. Mine. Or maybe I had it backward. Maybe I belonged to it. Neither arrangement was any guarantee of safety. I expected it wanted to kill me just as badly as any hollow would, only something had temporarily plugged the urge. It was the same mysterious thing that had magnetized the hollow to me and tuned the compass needle inside me to it, and it was this needle that told me the hollow was close now, and getting closer. Just in time to get us caught, or killed, or kill us itself. I resolved then that should we make it safely to shore, my first order of business would be to get rid of it once and for all. But where was it? If it was as close as it seemed to be, it would have been swimming toward us in the ditch, and I definitely would have heard a creature with 7 limbs doing the breaststroke. Then the needle shifted and dipped, and I knew, could see, almost, that it was under the water. Hollows did not, apparently, need to breathe often. A moment later there came a gentle thunk as it attached itself to the bottom of our boat. We all jumped at the sound, but only I knew what it was. I wished I could warn my friends, but I had to lie motionless, its body just inches away on the other side of the wooden boards we lay upon.
"What was that?"
I heard the first man say.
"I didn't hear anything,"
Sharon lied. "Let go," I mouthed silently, hoping the hollow could hear. "Go away and leave us alone." Instead, it began to make a grinding sound against the wood. I pictured it gnawing at the bottom of the boat with its long teeth.
"I heard that plain as day," said the second man. "Boatman's trying to make us look like fools, Reg."
"I think he is at that," said the first.
"I assure you, nothing could be further from the truth," said Sharon. "It's this damned defective boat of mine. Past due for a tune-up."
"Forget it. Deal's off. Show us what you got."
"Or you could allow me to increase my offer," said Sharon. "We'll consider it a gratuity for all your kind understanding."
The men conferred in an undertone.
"If we let him go and someone else catches him with feeders, it's the pit for us."
"Or worse."
"Go away, go away, go away,"
I begged the hollow in English.
Thud, thud, thud,
it answered, knocking against the hull.
"Pull back that rag,"
demanded the first man.
"Sir, if you would just wait a moment."
But the men were determined. Our boat rocked like someone was boarding it. There were shouts, then footfalls near our heads as a scuffle broke out. "There's no point hiding now," I thought, and the others seemed to agree. I saw Emma's glowing hot fingers reach for the edge of the tarp.
"On three," she whispered. "Ready?"
"As a racehorse,"
Addison growled.
"Wait," I said. "First you should know, under the boat, there's..."
And then the tarp was ripped away, and I never did finish that sentence. What happened next happened fast. Addison bit the arm that had torn away the tarp, and Emma made a swipe at its surprised owner, grazing the man's face with scalding fingers. He stumbled back, howling, and fell into the water. Sharon had been knocked down in the scuffle, and the second man was standing above him with his club raised. Addison leapt at him and grabbed hold of his leg. The man turned to shake off the dog, giving Sharon time to regain his feet, and hit him in the stomach. The man doubled over, and Sharon disarmed him with the tricky whirl of his staff. The man decided to quit while he could and leapt back into his boat. Sharon tore away the canvas covering the outboard motor, yanked its ignition cord, and our boat sputtered to life, just as a third came speeding out of the murk alongside us. Inside were three more men, one armed with an old-fashioned pistol that was leveled right at Emma. I shouted at her to get down and tackled her just as it cracked and sent up a puff of white smoke. Then the man pointed it at Sharon, who let go of the throttle and put his hands up. And that would have been it for us, I think, had not a throat full of strange words come gushing up and pouring out of me, loud and sure and foreign to my ears.
"Sink their boat! Use your tongues to sink their boat!"
In the half-second it took everyone to turn and stare at me, the hollow had pushed off from our hole and flung its tongues at the other boat. They fired out of the water, whipped around the lip of its stern, and flipped the boat up and backward in a reverse somersault that launched all three men out. The boat crashed upside down on two of them. Sharon might have taken the opportunity to hit the throttle and get us out of there, but he stood frozen in shock, his hands still raised. Which was fine. I wasn't done yet anyhow.
"That one,"
I said, looking at the gunman flailing in the water. It seemed the hollow could hear me underwater because moments after I'd said it, the man screamed, looked down, and was sucked under. Gone, just like that. And immediately the water where he'd been bloomed red.
"I didn't say eat him,"
I said in English.
"What are you waiting for?"
Emma shouted at Sharon.
"Go!"
Right,
the boatman stammered. Shaking off his stupor, he lowered his hands and leaned on the throttle. The motor whined and Sharon turned the rudder and spun us in a tight circle, tripping Emma, Addison, and me into a pile. The boat bucked and shot forward, and then we were speeding through whirls of murk, heading back the way we'd come. Emma looked at me and I looked back, and though it was too loud to hear anything over the motor and the rush of blood in our ears, I thought I could read in her face both fear and exhilaration, a look that said, "You, Jacob Portman, are amazing and terrifying." But when she finally spoke, I could make out only one word.
"Where?"
Where indeed? I'd hoped we could get away from the hollow while it was finishing off the ditch pirate, but reading my gut, now I knew it was still close, trailing behind us, most likely using one of its tongues as a tow line.
"Close,"
I mouthed back. Her eyes brightened, and she nodded once, sharply.
"Good."
I shook my head. Why wasn't she afraid? Why couldn't she see how dangerous it was? The hollow had tasted blood and just left a meal half-finished behind us. Who knew what meanness still boiled inside it? But the way she looked at me, just that crooked bit of smile gave me a surge, and I felt I could do anything. We were coming up fast on the bridge and the murk making peculiar. He was waiting for us, crouching and sighting us down the length of a rifle he'd rested on the bridge's handrail. We ducked. I heard two shots. Looking up again, I saw that no one had been hit. We were going under the bridge. In a moment we'd be out the other side, and he'd have another shot at us. I couldn't let him take it. I turned and shouted, "Bridge!" in hollow speak. And the creature seemed to know just what I meant. The two tongues that weren't holding on to our boat whipped upward, and with a wet slap, each one wrapped around the bridge's flimsy supports. All three tongues unreeled triangularly until they were pulled taut, like elastic stretched to the limit. The hollow was forced up out of the water, tethered between boat and bridge like a starfish. The boat slowed so quickly it was like someone had thrown the emergency brake. We were all tossed forward onto the floor. The bridge groaned and rocked, and the peculiar taking aim at us stumbled and dropped his gun. I thought that surely either the bridge would give or the hollow would. It was squealing like a stuck pig, as if it might rip down the middle. But as the peculiar bent to snatch his gun, it seemed the bridge would hold, which meant I'd traded all our momentum and speed for nothing. Now we weren't even moving targets.
"Let go!"
I screamed at the hollow, this time in its language. It didn't. The thing would never leave me of its own accord. So I rushed to the back of the boat and bellied over the stern. There was one of its tongues knotted around the rudder. Remembering how Emma's touch had once made a hollow's tongue release her ankle, I pulled her over and told her to burn the rudder. She did, nearly falling over the side to make the reach, and the hollow squealed and let go. It was like releasing a slingshot. The hollow flew away and slammed into the bridge with a splintering crash. The whole tottering contraption buckled and went tumbling into the water. At the same time, the back of our boat dropped, and the motor, once again submerged, flung us forward. The sudden acceleration toppled us like bowling pins. Sharon managed to hold on to the rudder, and righting himself, he steered us sharply away from a collision course with the canal wall. We flew down the spine of the ditch, a black V of water shooting out behind us. We hunched low should any more bullets fly. We seemed to be out of immediate danger. The vultures were somewhere behind us, and I couldn't imagine how they'd catch us now. Panting, Addison said, "That was the same creature we met in the underground, wasn't it?" I realized I'd been holding my breath, and so let it out, then nodded. Emma looked at me, waiting for more, but I was still processing, every nerve jangling with the strangeness of what had just happened. This much I knew. This time I'd nearly had him. It was as if, with each encounter, I dove a little deeper into the hologast's nerve center. The words came easier, felt less foreign to my tongue, met less resistance from the hollow. Still, it was like a tiger onto which I'd managed to clap a dog leash. At any moment it might decide to turn and take a bite out of me, or any of us. And yet, for reasons beyond my understanding, it hadn't. Maybe, I thought, with another attempt or two, I could really get my hands around it. And then, my God, what a thought. Then we'd be unstoppable. I gazed back at the ghost of a bridge, dust and wood pulp spiraling in the air where the structure had stood only moments ago. In the wreckage below, I watched for a limb to break the surface, but there was only a lifeless swirl of trash. I tried to feel for it, but my gut was useless now, wrung out and empty. Then the mud-colored mist closed behind us and painted away the view. Just when I needed a monster, it had gotten itself killed. The boat nodded as Sharon eased the throttle and banked right, through the slowly clearing murk, toward a block of ghastly tenements. They stood at the edge of the water in a vast unbroken wall, resembling not so much houses as the outermost boundary of a maze, scowling and fortress-like, with few points of entry. We drifted along at a crawl, searching for a way in. It was Emma who finally spotted one, though I had to squint to recognize it as more than just a trick of shadows. To call it an alley would have been exaggerating. It was a slot canyon, narrow as a knife's edge, a shoulder's width from wall to wall and 50 times as high, its entrance marked by a moss-shagged ladder screwed flat to the bankside. I could see only a little distance in before the passage hid itself, curving away into sunless dark. "Where does it go?" I asked.
"Where angels fear to tread," Sharon replied. "This wasn't the landing I'd have chosen for you, but our choices are limited now. Are you certain you wouldn't rather leave the acre altogether? There's still time."
"Quite certain," Emma and Addison said simultaneously. Me? I would have been happy to debate the matter, but it was too late to turn back now. Get them back or die trying was something I'd said in the past few days. Time to dive in.
"In that case, land ho," Sharon said dryly.
He retrieved the mooring rope from under his seat, tossed it over the ladder, and pulled us toward the bank.
"Everyone out, please. Do watch your step. Wait, allow me."
Sharon climbed the slippery, half-runged ladder with the nimbleness of someone who'd done it many times. Once at the top, he knelt on the bank and reached down to help each of us up in turn. Emma went first, then I handed up a nervous and wiggling Addison, and then, because I was proud and dumb, I climbed the ladder without taking Sharon's hand and nearly slipped off. The moment we were all safely on land, Sharon was climbing back down the ladder. He'd left the motor idling.
"Just a minute," said Emma. "Where are you going?"
"Away from here,"
Sharon replied, hopping from the ladder into his boat.
"Would you mind tossing down that rope?"
"I will not! You must show us where to go first. We've no idea where we are."
"I don't do land tours. I'm strictly a boat guide."
We exchanged looks of disbelief.
"Give us directions, at least," I implored him.
"Or, better yet, a map," said Addison.
"A map!"
Sharon exclaimed, as if this were the silliest thing he'd ever heard.
"There are more thief passageways, murder tunnels, and illegal dens in Devil's Acre than anywhere in the world. The place is unmappable. Now stop being childish and hand me down my rope."
"Not until you tell us something useful," Emma said. "The name of someone we can ask for help, who won't try to sell us to the whites."
Sharon broke out laughing. Emma struck a defiant pose.
"There must be one."
Sharon bowed.
"You're speaking to him,"
then climbed the ladder halfway and plucked his rope from Emma's hands.
"Enough of this. Goodbye, children. I'm quite sure I'll never see you again."
And with that, he stepped into his boat and right into a puddle of ankle-deep water. He let out a girlish squeal and bent down to look. It seemed the gunshots that missed our heads had drilled a few holes in his hull, and the boat had sprung leaks.
"Look what you've done! My boat shot all to pieces!"
Emma's eyes flashed.
"What we've done?"
Sharon made a quick inspection and concluded the wounds were grave.
"I am marooned,"
he announced dramatically, then cut the motor, collapsing his long staff to the size of a baton, and climbed the ladder again.
"I'm going to find a craftsman qualified to repair my dinghy," he said, breezing past us, "and I won't have you following me."
We trailed him single file into the narrow passageway.
"Then why not?"
Emma shrilled.
"Because you're cursed! Bad luck!"
Sharon waved his arm behind him as if shooing flies.
"Begone!"
"What do you mean, begone?"
She jogged a few paces and grabbed Sharon by his cloaked elbow. He spun around fast and yanked it away, and I thought for a moment his raised hand was about to strike her. I tensed, ready to leap at him, but his hand just hung there. A warning.
"I've run this route more times than I can count, and not once have I been attacked by ditch pirates. Never have I been forced to abandon cover and use my petrol engine. And never, ever has my boat been damaged. You're more trouble than you're worth, plain and simple, and I want nothing more to do with you."
While he spoke, I glanced past him down the passage. My eyes were still adjusting to the dark, but what I could see was terrifying. Winding and maze-like, it was lined with doorless doorways that gaped like missing teeth, and it was alive with sinister sounds, murmurs, scrapes, scurrying steps. Even now I could feel hungry eyes watching us, knives being drawn. We couldn't be left here alone. The only thing to do was beg.
"We'll pay double what we promised," I said.
and fix your boat," Addison chimed in.
"Never mind your bloody pocket change," Sharon said. "Can't you see I'm ruined? How can I return to Devil's Acre? Do you think the vultures will ever let me be now that my clients have killed two of them?"
"What did you want us to do?" Emma said. "We had to fight back."
"Don't be facile. They would never have forced the issue if it wasn't for that."
Sharon looked at me, his voice falling to a whisper.
"You might have mentioned earlier you were in league with creatures of the night."
I said awkwardly. "I wouldn't say in league with, exactly."
"There isn't much in this world I fear, but as a rule I keep my distance from soul-sucking monsters, and apparently you've got one following you like a bloodhound. I suppose it'll be along any minute?"
"Not likely," Addison said. "Don't you recall, some moments ago, when a bridge fell on its head?"
"Only a small one," Sharon said. "Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to see a man about a boat."
And with that, he hurried away. Before we could catch up to him, he'd rounded a corner, and by the time we reached it, he'd disappeared. Vanished, perhaps, into one of those tunnels he'd mentioned. We stood turning circles, confounded and afraid.
"I can't believe he'd just abandon us like this," I said.
"Neither can I," Addison replied coolly. "In fact, I don't think he has. I think he's negotiating." The dog cleared his throat, sat up on his hind legs, and addressed the rooftops in a booming voice.
"Good sir, we mean to rescue our friends and our Imbrins, and mark me, we will. And when we do, and they learn how you've aided us, they'll be most grateful."
He let that ring out for a moment, then went on.
"Never mind compassion, fie on loyalty. If you're as intelligent and ambitious a fellow as I think you are, then you'll recognize an extraordinary opportunity for advancement when you see one. We are indebted to you already, but scrounging coins from children and animals is an awfully modest living compared to what having several Imbrins in your debt could mean. Perhaps you'd enjoy having a loop all to yourself, your own personal playground with no other peculiars to spoil it. Any time and any place you like. A lush summer isle in an age of abiding peace. Some lowly pit in a time of plague. As you prefer."
"Could they really do that?" I whispered to Emma. Emma shrugged.
"Imagine the possibilities," Addison gushed.
His voice echoed away. We waited, listening. Somewhere two people were arguing. A hacking cough. Something heavy was dragged down steps.
"Well, it was a nice speech," Emma sighed.
"Forget him, then," I said, peering into the passages that branched away, left, right, and straight ahead.
"Which way?"
We chose a passage at random, straight on, and started down it. We'd gone only 10 paces when we heard a voice say,
"I wouldn't go that way if I were you. That's Cannibal's Alley, and it isn't just a cute nickname."
There was Sharon behind us, hands on his hips like a fitness coach.
"My heart must be getting soft in my old age," he said. "Either that or my head."
"Does that mean you'll help us?" said Emma.
A light rain had begun to fall. Sharon looked up, letting a little splash his hidden face.
"I know a lawyer here. First I want you to sign a contract laying out what you owe me.
Fine, fine, said Emma. But you'll help us.
Then I've got to see about getting my boat fixed.
And then?
Then I'll help you, yes. Though I can't promise any results, and I want to state at the outset that I think you're all fools.
We couldn't quite bring ourselves to thank him, given what he'd put us through.
Now, stay close, and follow every instruction I give you to the letter. You killed 2 vultures today, and they'll be hunting you. Mark my words.
We readily agreed.
If they catch you, you don't know me. Never saw me.
We nodded like bobbleheads.
And whatever you do, never, never touch so much as a drop of ambrosia, or on my eyes, you'll never leave this place.
I don't know what that is, I said, and from their expressions I saw that Emma and Addison were likewise in the dark.
You'll find out,
Sharon said ominously, and with a swish of his cloak, he turned and plunged into the maze. Chapter 3 Just before a cow is put to the hammer in a modern slaughterhouse, it is prodded through a winding maze. The tight curves and blind corners prevent the animal from seeing more than a short distance ahead, so it doesn't realize until the last few steps, when the maze abruptly narrows and a metal collar clamps tight around its neck, where the journey has taken it. But as the three of us hurried after Sharon into the heart of Devil's Acre, I felt sure I knew what was coming, if not when, nor how. With each step and each turn, we threaded deeper inside a knot, one I feared we'd never work apart. The fetid air did not move, its only outlet an uneven crack of sky high above our heads. The bulged and slumping walls were so narrow that we had to go shoulder first in places, the tight spots greased black by the clothes of those who'd gone before. There was nothing natural here, nothing green, nothing living at all, save scurrying vermin and the bloodshot-eyed revenants who lurked behind doorways and under grates in the street, and who surely would have jumped at us if not for our towering, black-clad guide. We were chasing death himself into the pit of hell. We turned and turned again. Every passage looked just like the one before it. There were no signs, no markers. Either Sharon was navigating by some brilliant feat of memory, or completely at random, trying to throw off any ditch pirates who might have been pursuing us.
"Do you really know where we're going?" Emma asked him.
"Of course I do!"
Sharon barked, bombing around a corner without looking back. Then he stopped, doubled back, and stepped down through a doorway sunk half below street level. Inside was a dank cellar just 5 feet high and lit by the merest breath of sallow gray light. We ran hunched along a subterranean corridor, discarded animal bones underfoot, the ceiling brushing our heads, past things I tried not to see. A slumped figure in a corner, sleepers shivering on miserable mats of straw, a boy in rags lying on the ground with a beggar's pail bangled around one arm. At its far end, the passage widened into a room, and in the light of a few grimed windows, there knelt a pair of miserable washerwomen, scrubbing laundry in a stinking pool of ditch water. Then we mounted more steps and went out, thank God, into a walled courtyard common to the backs of several buildings. In some other reality, it might have contained a happy patch of grass or a little gazebo, but this was Devil's Acre, and it was a dump and a pigsty. Waves of fly-blown trash tossed from windows crested against the walls, and in the center staked crookedly in the mud, was a wooden pen in which a skinny boy stood guarding an even skinnier pig. Just one. By a mud brick wall, a woman sat smoking and reading a newspaper, while a young girl stood behind her, picking nits from her hair. The woman and girl took no notice as we trooped past, but the boy leaned the tines of a pitchfork at us. When it was clear we had no designs on his pig, he sank into an exhausted squat. Emma stopped in the middle of the yard to look up at lines of laundry strung between roof gutters. She pointed out again that our blood-stained clothes made us look like participants in a murder, and suggested we should change. Sharon replied that murderers were hardly outlandish here, and urged her on, but she hung back, arguing that a white in the underground had seen our blood-stained clothes and radioed his comrades about us. They made us too easy to pick out of a crowd. Really, I think it was more that she felt uncomfortable in a blouse now stiff with another person's blood. I did, too, and if we found our friends again, I didn't want them to see us like this. Sharon grudgingly assented. He'd been leading us toward a fence at the edge of the yard, but now pivoted and took us into one of the buildings. We climbed 2, 3, 4 flights of stairs, until even Addison was wheezing, then followed Sharon through an open door into a small, squalid room. A gash in the ceiling had let in rain and warped the landing like ripples in a pond. Black mold veined the walls. At a table by a smoky window, 2 women and a girl were sweating over foot-powered sewing machines.
"We need some clothes,"
Sharon said, addressing the women in a stentorian basso that shook the thin walls. Their pale faces looked up. One of the women picked up a sewing needle and gripped it like a weapon.
"Please," she said.
Sharon reached up and pulled back the hood of his cloak a little, so that only the seamstresses could see his face. They gasped, then whimpered, and fainted forward onto the table. "Was that really necessary?" I said.
"Not strictly,"
Sharon replied, replacing his hood.
"But it was expedient."
The seamstresses had been assembling simple shirts and dresses from scraps of cloth. The rags they worked with were heaped around the floor, and the results, which had more patches and seams than Frankenstein's monster, were hung on a line out the window. As Emma reeled them in, my gaze crawled around the room. It was clearly more than just a workspace. The women lived here, too. There was a bed nailed together from scrap wood. I peered into a dented pot that hung in the hearth and saw the makings of starvation soup, fish skin and withered cabbage leaves. Their half-hearted attempts at decorating, a sprig of dried flowers, a horseshoe nailed to the mantel, a framed portrait of Queen Victoria, were somehow sadder than nothing at all. Despair was tangible here. Weighing down everything, the very air. I'd never been confronted with such pure misery. Could peculiars really be living these discarded lives? As Sharon pulled in an armful of shirts through the window, I asked him. He seemed almost offended by the idea.
"Peculiars would never allow themselves to be so reduced. These are common slum dwellers, trapped in an endless repetition of the day this loop was made. Normals occupy the acre's festering edges, but its heart belongs to us."
They were normals. Not only that, but loop-trapped normals, like the ones on Cairnholm, whom the crueler kids would torment during games of Raid the Village. As much a part of the background scenery as the sea or the cliffs, I told myself. But somehow, looking at the women's weathered faces buried in rags, I felt no less terrible about stealing from them.
I'm sure we'll know the peculiars when we see them, Emma said, sorting through a pile of dirty blouses.
One always does.